You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Esther Partegas. She is an artist and living in Richmond, Virginia. Esther, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Esther, tell us a little bit about what's happening in your studio now. I know you're doing a number of things and you're teaching, but what's happening in your studio? Are you preparing for something particular or working on a specific project?
Yes, sure. I am finishing a small solo show that will be open here in Richmond, in one of the galleries that the university has, the Anderson Gallery. And it consists of a wallpaper, a black and white photocopy wallpaper, and three light boxes. And the light boxes will have these photos in full color. The light boxes will be installed on top of the wallpaper. And this show is only like this one big room with this photographic installation. So this is the most immediate. And then I'm working on new ideas that are just in progress, nothing completely finished or completely resolved. But that deal also with wallpaper, tarps, scaffolding, covers. I'm with all these ideas right now.
And so that's an experiment of what may happen, works that may be exhibited somewhere else.
I mean, it's an experiment, but it's the way I always work, knowing a little bit and not knowing a lot, and just going, experimenting in the studio and trying new things and carrying maybe older ideas or older techniques, ways to do it, but also incorporating a lot of not what I don't know yet. So, yes.
Sure. Okay, let's talk a little bit about maybe your beginnings. When you were a child or a little older, do you remember when you first got interested in art or began making art?
I can tell you when I began being interested, because I do remember a very specific moment that blew my mind. And at that moment, I think the idea of art or contemporary art really entered my small brain. And it was visiting the Dalí Museum in Figueras, it's pretty unconventional as a museum, because it has a lot of installation and a lot of he used a lot of objects installed and installations and videos and performance recorded.
Where was that museum? That was in Spain. That was in
a city, in a small city called Figueras.
Right.
That's where Dalí. Yeah, between that and Caracas, those were the main places where Dalí lived. So there is a museum there that it's very interesting, and it's very, as I said, unconventional.
I've been to that museum. I know that museum. I remember the eggs on the top, and I remember going in there, and there was a wonderful museum. I remember there's a car in there, as I remember, that I'd never seen anywhere, where you put coins in and it rains inside the car. Yeah. So go on. As a child,
so the facade, the facade is he plays these like little small bread of a specific shape, covering the facade in a very beautiful way. So of course I was like, wow, this fantasy, right? Like this whole imagination. And what shocked me was that it looked all very crazy, extremely crazy. But it was full of people, and people look serious and seem interested, and they were not making fun of the situation. So this, for me, was a contradiction. It's like, oh, wow, they take all this seriously. So I thought, wow, that's what I want to be doing, that people take me seriously for all this imaginative world,
And how old were you then?
You know, I don't remember, but I assume between maybe 6 or 9, between the age of 6 or 9 years old. Yeah. Yeah.
And had you been making art then, or you just thought this is a fantastic kind of world that you wanted to be in? It was
I think I made as much art as anyone else at that age, you know, and you're just not aware that that's called art and it's a specific discipline. You just do what you're told, and I guess you enjoy everything. So no, I was not aware that, you know, I was making art specifically, and it took me a much longer time after that. But at least I had some names and somewhere to start.
And what was the next step in high school? Were you encouraged to make more? How did you
move
forward?
I don't know. I think I didn't have very good teachers in that sense, so I was very curious and I was very demanding. But I remember very, very boring high school teachers that would just, I think the drawing or the art class would be for them just like, okay, draw, I don't know, what you did on the weekend, and kind of leave me alone. So I was always very bored. I would try to get other classes outside high school, but I'm from a very small town, so there weren't many options. But I would constantly nag my parents to go to Barcelona, to go to the museums. You know, we have this access there that even if you don't, if you're not interested specifically in art, we have these characters. They become characters now, right? Dalí, Picasso, Miró, Tapia, that you have them all over the city, you know. With a lot of merchandise, posters, and T-shirts, but they have become part of your regular landscape. So I was always drawn to those images, you know, and to those worlds that these artists were featuring, you know. So I wanted to see more of that all the time. So it was fairly easy to, okay, let's go to the Miró, you know, Foundation. Let's go to the Picasso Museum. So I remember being very interested with all these. And, of course, then the architecture of Gaudí, everything that was very, very available in Barcelona. That was my school, kind of.
right, which is, of course, very unlike anything here in the States. There's not that visual culture around us. There's not those kind of museums. I know when I first traveled to Spain, I couldn't believe, you know, in France, too, these museums that are built for a single artist. I don't think that occurs here, where there's, you know, a Picasso museum, a Leger museum, Dalí museum. It's really quite incredible how that's valued. So then, what was the next step for art? You're out of high school, and did you think that you wanted to go to college for art? Was that the next step?
Yeah. You know, I was very confused in high school because I think I had a lot of interest, but I didn't have any mentor or someone older than me with more experience that could help me figure out anything. So I felt very alone there. And expressing all these artistic, you know, I was interested in theater, in anything that felt artistic, you know. I was drawn to that. And my parents would, I think, were scared and didn't know and thought that I would be just this crazy, you know, bohemian person. And so they were only trying to stop it, you know. I was a pretty difficult teenager in that sense, and because I felt like I was looking for something that was kind of like forbidden or was, you know, like was not supposed to happen. And of course, back then there was no internet, so access to things were very, very, you know, they had to be analog and manual, and you really had to physically displace yourself somewhere else to make sure that those things existed. So I, in high school, I was not very aware. I tried, and my parents were just like, they started insinuating graphic design or interior design that seemed much more dignified for them. But then I finished high school, and I didn't apply to the fine arts university, but I applied to this a smaller private school that my parents really insisted I should go. And I think for them was it signified a little bit of money, but it was the sacrifice that they thought they had to do to shape me to a better place, you know. And they wanted me to take the graphic design or interior design. So I went to that school and I took the exam to get in. But of course, my exam was completely like I was expressing all my you know, desires to be an artist, and they made me talk about which graphic designers I liked, and I had no idea of any graphic designer. And so I just started rambling about artists. So, you know, after the exam, the chair of the department talked to me, and she said she wanted to talk to my parents, and I didn't understand. And basically that talk, the chair of the department convinced my parents that I should take the art classes. And I think that kind of was it. From then on, I was like, okay. You know, it's not I am crazy. It's like, you know, someone more important than me sees that I have these skills and capacity to be an artist, so let's do it, you know. But, yeah, it wasn't easy, I think. It wasn't easy being from a small town back then, you know, in the 80s.
Yeah. So then you went into it was the same school, but it was for fine art. Is that what happened?
Yes, yeah, and I did that 1 year, but then, of course, during that year, a lot of doors opened up, and I had access to a lot of information, and the next year, I went and did the exam to enter the Fine Arts University, like the proper, you know, official big place, although I stayed like an extra year to finish the studies also in this private school. So, yeah, and then I did the full 5 years, which is the equivalent that here we would call the undergrad and grad in the Fine Arts University of Barcelona.
So now you finished graduate school in Barcelona. That must have been an undergrad. That must have been a lot of influences there that must have changed how you were looking at the art world, I would imagine.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, it's a very, very big school. We are not given much personal attention compared to the education we have here in the States. So I remember it was more like, okay, just go to all these classes and mix with these huge, you know, amounts of students, but very, very little access to real creeds or real like real relationships with the teachers or mentors. You know, I remember being very left alone and, you know, do your homework, but don't take more of my time. So I was quite unsatisfied with that education, to tell you the truth. And even the 2 years of graduation there that I specialized in sculpture were very similar. They don't even give you a studio. You have access to the tools, but you don't really have a much place to work. They were not even holding creeds in that department, so it was not a super interesting education.
Right.
It was an
education to survive. I mean, that you survived, that was good, and kept making art. I suppose it doesn't sound most encouraging.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. I never thought it like that, but it's true. It was survival, like do your homework, you know, pass the grade, you know, have a decent grade and move on, you know. But again, I think what for me was fascinating was the city itself. And I remember even not attending a lot of classes and just like taking the subway and discovering Barcelona, you know, a lot of places and spending the tapias Antoni Tàpies, the painter, had just opened in the early 90s his own foundation, so his own museum in the center of the city. And what was amazing, and it just feels beautiful, he his own private books, his whole library, was open to the public. And it's hosted in that building, which is so beautiful. It's what here we would call an Art Deco building. So you had to call and reserve a seat. And I was there all the time in that library. And I was alone. And I felt that that was the biggest gift, you know, to have all these books that belong to Tàpies be shared, that he would share with everyone. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, that's where I learned everything. I was there all the time instead of being in class.
Wow, that's a kind of a wonderful idea too, to leave a whole library. I mean, especially in that context of educating and inspiring artists, for Tàpies to have set that up is a wonderful way to see also exactly what he was looking at and how he was thinking and what he was reading. And he becomes your mentor in a way by
exactly. Yeah, by sharing all.
And then what? So then you graduate, and what was the next step? You're out into the world. You have to get a job in graphic design or interior design.
I never learned any graphic design, but I guess because of all these hardships and resistance that I felt always growing up in the small town, and then this university that was so boring, and also I felt it always as a repressive and very resistant, you know, place. I always knew I would leave Spain. It was so clear in my mind since I was very little. I had no doubt about that. I was just like, I know, I had this super confidence that once I could, you know, I would just leave. So I left immediately as soon as I graduated. I left and I went to Berlin. And what I did was, you know, there are these Erasmus exchange programs in Europe that, you know, they give you like 3 months, and basically you go to another university, and that university sends another student to your own university. So it's an exchange. And normally it happens during your studies with the idea that you still have to return and finish in your original university. But I tweaked something, and what I did is like I graduated from Barcelona, but I paid an extra class or two, so officially I was still a student. So I could be sent to Berlin. I wanted to go to Berlin or to Glasgow. Those were my two options. And so I was sent to Berlin to the Hareka, the University of Fine Arts there. And then I never came back. You know, I lost the money of those two classes, but I just wanted to have a place, you know, to have a place somewhere else. So I went there, and that's where I started trying to find jobs. And it was just like, you know, waitressing here and there, and restaurants, like the, you know, the most like, basic kind of jobs. And while I was in Berlin, the school, these 3 months, gave me a studio. And during these 3 months, I started the application process to do another graduate studies there of 2 years. So I was accepted, and I spent basically almost 2 years there again. And it was a very, very different educational system, but it was fantastic. There was completely the opposite of Barcelona. There were almost no teachers. No one was around ever, but they gave you a key, and they gave you a huge studio and the facilities. And I thought that was fantastic. You know, it's like, wow, you know, I just have this space here for free, because education is so, so cheap there. I would just go get these jobs outside in the city and then go to my studio and really, really work there. That's where I really started with my own ideas and making art.
And was that also a supportive community there? Did you find the people also more supportive than in Spain? How was the community of artists there?
You know, it was not at all. It's funny. I'm talking about Berlin like in 96 and 97, and it still was a very unattractive place for people. Barely in 97, 98, a couple of small galleries would started to open, but the city itself was still in this process of maybe trying to change, trying to westernize the whole place, but not quite there. So it was an obscure place, and in the university too. The people in the university the students were very competitive, and they were not sharing information much. There was not this sense of community, let's all be together and help each other. On the contrary, it was extremely competitive and not very friendly. So again, I was very alone, but it was the first time in my life that I felt that loneliness, that's exactly what I needed, because I was doing these jobs just to make a decent living, and I just wanted to be alone in that studio, and because I had done all these years of school, I felt like I had enough information that I could just do whatever I wanted, you know, and build my body of work. So in that sense, was very good, but I always say that somehow my educational process, my learning process came from not having, instead of having, from this lack of not having and me being hungry and trying to find it, you know, in unconventional ways. And then the internet arrived, you know, after all this.
So what happened? So you're working in Berlin and you're going through school there, and after school, when did you have your first exhibit, or maybe just what was next after you finished school in Berlin? What did you do then?
Well, what happened is that before I left Barcelona to move to Berlin, I met this guy who became my boyfriend, and he was also an artist. And when I moved to Berlin, he moved to New York. He had applied for a grant that he had, you know, he had always wanted to go to London or New York. And it just happened at the same time we met, we fell madly in love, and boom, I was going to Berlin and he was going to New York. So he came, of course, he came to visit a few times, and I went to New York a few times. And then at some point, we had to stop the relationship, or one had to move to another city. So at the end, it was me moving to New York. Although I resisted a lot because I was really invested with the idea of Berlin, and I learned my German, and I really didn't want to move. And New York felt too far, and it was not even in my map. It was like, but then I visited a few times, and New York felt so different than Berlin. I remember, you know, you just, people say, how are you today? Good morning. In Berlin, no one talked to you like that. You know, people were like so nasty and so angry all the time. And so suddenly I go to New York and everything, you have information everywhere. You know, it's a very exterior society. You know, they tell you, they ask you, and information circulates, and you meet people very easily of your age and with similar economies and interests and conditions, and people tell you, oh, there is an opening here. Oh, why don't you come there? So for me, it was like, wow, this is a paradise. I didn't know it existed. So
And that was what year? Which was the first year you came to New
York? Yeah, 97. And we were in the East Village, and Yeah, that's, and I felt that even though my, you know, like I was very sure that I, you know, that I had, that my investment was in Berlin. When I came, New York seduced me. The daily life of New York, the energy of New York seduced me so much. I was like, wow, maybe this is what I've always been looking for, you know, just like full energy and street energy and no drama. You know, I think Europe, we carry a lot of drama, historical drama, you know, and a lot of that. And here, just like, no, if you can do it, do it. If, you know, you want to use it, you use it, and then you go and do something else. And I love that. So I moved here very, very quickly. And actually, I think I missed the last 6 months of the last 6 months of school in Berlin because I had already just moved here. And then I had to go back to take my last exam, the thesis exam in Berlin. And I was in shock. I was like, you know, like now, okay, let's think in German again. Let's do this. I did my exam and came back. And since then, I haven't left this country. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I was in the East Village at just that same time in the 90s, had a storefront there. And that was a great time. So then what was your first exhibit in New York? You still haven't really exhibited your work, right? You've been in school. You're now in New York. What was your first show?
So I had a friend in New York that I had met in this small private school in Barcelona, and he is an American artist. I've lost contact with him. I don't know where he must be now, but his name was Dylan, or is Dylan Stone, and we had bonded a few years back in Barcelona, and then when I came here, I contacted him. And he was so sweet and nice in this American way, like, hey, I'll share everything I have with you. You know, let's go see galleries. So he introduced me a little bit to the world of galleries that were still in Soho. And he introduced me to a gallery that was called Fotui Kramer and was on the Dean and DeLuca building. And I don't know if you remember this place. I think it was the second or third floor on top of Dean and DeLuca. Anyway, like they liked that, you know, I showed them just a few works I did in Berlin. They liked them, and they gave me a show, you know, in one of these, like, second rooms that maybe back then were fashionable to call project rooms. Now no one uses this name anymore. Do you remember? Yeah. Because they had, like, the main space. Yeah, and then they might have a backspace smaller for more experimental or younger people. So I had that, and I started working towards that. It was a small installation with slides and little sculptures. And, you know, that show brought me other shows. So very little by little, you know, it was kind of easy to get these group shows and started like that. And it felt so natural and so it's like, okay, that's the way to go. You know, people are interested. They come to the shows, they talk about it, and you go to their shows and there are connections and the dialogue is unstoppable in this city. So it felt like all very fluid, you know, very fluid. And that's how it all happened, little by little, but steadily, you know, with a lot of energy.
So it's interesting for you, New York felt, and I share that, but not everyone does, but New York felt very welcoming, very warm, and a place where, you know, by yourself, you could meet people and have access to galleries and talk to people. Is that was your experience there?
Yes, yeah. And I'm not saying it wasn't hard. It was super hard. Economically, you know, that's super hard, and it's hard maybe in other things. Basically, all these like the lack of space, you know, all these very physical, you know, the physical situation and the economic situation. But the energy and the human and the artistic, it was a paradise. It was like swimming in the river if you're a fish type of thing.
Right.
Yeah, everyone spoke your language. You know, your language was there.
Right.
As an artist,
and,
yeah.
And where, when in New York? So then you're in New York, and you're at that gallery. Was there a first moment when you began selling work, or feeling like this is really your career? Was there another turning point at that stage?
No, I think I wasn't aware of that. It was just like I was just so grateful and happy to be showing and be part of this bigger community. But I still had like to survive, and I had like, you know, terrible jobs. Like during the day, I learned a lot about, you know, drywall and building, and I work with all these guys in construction. I also did some welding for Nam June Paik sculptures, you know, neon for Nam June Paik, the assistant of Nam June Paik, something like that. So I was really struggling, yeah, during the day, like from one thing to the other. And I would go to the studio at 9 p.m. or 8 p.m. at the end of a full day. But little by little, I guess I started becoming more and more busy with my art. And then I kind of got a proper job. It felt strange because it was my first proper job at Zing Magazine. Are you familiar with the magazine?
Zing Magazine, sure, by Devin DeCoux Magazine.
Devin DeCoux, yeah, which is still going on. It's still publishing once or twice a year. So through a friend, you know, I started interning there, and I loved it. You know, I was welcome into this small office full of, like, young people, and a lot of things were going through Zing Magazine because it was in Soho still. The galleries were in Soho. The bookstores were in Soho. So, you know, more like I interned for a long time, and in my spare time between these jobs that were not interesting, but the magazine was interesting. And then they started giving me more responsibilities, and I started getting paid. And then I had a full-time job at Zing Magazine for a few years. And I think in 2003, probably, that's when I had so many shows, and I already had a couple of galleries, and my small work, like drawings especially, were selling that I had to quit, you know. And it was sad for me to quit because I really, really loved that job and the people there. But I had to quit, and that's when I started living out of, you know, full-time artists, living out of my work. In 2003.
And that sounds like it happened so fast. I know it didn't, but I can imagine Zing Magazine as being very important, because that was also really the pulse of the art scene. What openings to go to, what's going on, where, what's, you know, I remember, you know, great little launch parties for the magazine, and kind of a wonderful community, I would imagine, there. How did all these shows suddenly happen? Were you also more aggressive in finding the shows, or it sounds like your career happened in sort of 3 years?
It was very quick. Yeah, you know, at that moment, you're not, you just go with the flow. It's like, oh, that's what happens, and you just assume that's how it is, and it's natural, and you go with it. And, you know, I was also so young, and now I realize with perspective, like, oh, my God, first, like, how on earth did I just went to New York without anything, like nothing? And I was completely fearless. But I had no money, and I just showed up. Okay, let's do this. And then also realizing how quick, you know, it happened for me in that sense. But at that time, it just felt normal. But I think I was also lucky. There is a detail that now with perspective, I understand it was very important. And when I moved here, my boyfriend was in the East Village, and when we decided that I was moving here, he spent like 2 months quite desperately finding a bigger room, because he was a roommate with other three people, and we needed a bigger bedroom, basically. And he was looking for that, and there was no place because everything felt so expensive that he kind of felt forced to go to Brooklyn, and he ended up in Williamsburg, right on Bedford and North 6th. And we were excited about that place, but also felt like kind of empty and weird. But bam, it was the beginning of Williamsburg. So we moved there in 97, and that's when a lot of artists like us moved there. And we start making a lot of friends just basically from hanging out in coffee shops. Like, you would get your coffee at 8 in the morning in the same place. And we were such small group of people that you would start just talking at the coffee shop. And I made friends waiting on the L train, because that L train stop was empty, believe it or not. It was just empty, and you would see the same people all the time, like, hey, who are you, blah, 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 you know. And we made a community of artists just like that. And those groups of people, we started taking spaces in Williamsburg and doing our own group shows just like that. And real estate guys would lend us these storefronts for free for a couple of months to promote, of course, their building and their, real estate property. So for us, we were like, you know, and I was like, wow, that was so naive in a way, but like, oh yeah, let's have a group show here. So I think I was very lucky to be at that moment in that place, you know, when it still was available and easy to circulate. So through those group shows there that were very rough in a way, you know, people from Manhattan start coming, you know, galleries and curators. And that's what brought me to Manhattan to have gallery shows and get gallery representation. And from there, a Spanish gallery was interested. And so it happened like that, I think, starting in Williamsburg in late 90s.
Right, and the gallery was Proxy Production, wasn't it?
No, the first one was DiChiara and Stewart. I don't know if you remember. It was one of the first galleries that opened. Was that 26th Street? One of the first galleries in Chelsea. And it was run by Lori DiChiara, then later to Berlin. So I started showing with them. And after a few years, Foxy opened on Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg, where I was still living. And we became friends first. And then I moved from the DiChiara Stewart to Foxy Production. And I'm still with Foxy, yes.
Mm-hmm. And they're still in Bedford? Where is Foxy now? No, they're in New York.
No.
Now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They moved to Manhattan a few years later, and they've had already like three different locations on 27th Street. And now they are in what was John Connolly Gallery on 27.
Right.
I don't know exactly the number. It's like 637 West. It's the last block on between 12th and 11th Avenue. Or 11th and 10th and 27th. There are like a row of galleries there.
Right, the gallery buildings there. So, and then the gallery in Spain. Your career is growing, and that almost brings us up to the present. That's kind of how your career developed in New York, and you're still based in New York, correct?
Well, I live in Richmond, Virginia. I moved to Richmond 2 years ago after all these years in New York. in a way, artistically, I'm still based in New York because I'm there every month, and that's still like my nurturing and my community of people are there. But
so why Richmond, Virginia? That sounds very
exactly.
Unusual for a Spaniard who loves New York, who was embraced by New York. I would think Richmond, Virginia is a little bit like Berlin in the 90s.
I wish, I hope. Then it would become this Berlin that they have right now. Well, several reasons. I had been in New York for all these years, maybe like 13 or 14 at that time. An important issue was that there was the crash of the market. And when was that? Like,
2009.
Exactly, yeah. So I really, really felt that. Suddenly I was not selling. I mean, like, that's clear. Or collectors were buying things and like, oh, yeah, this thing has sold, but they would not pay. Or they would pay, like, 6 months later. It became this real struggle economically. Because I was getting I was making a lot of sales in Spain, and you know how the situation is in Spain. If the market crash here, Spain is terrible. It's still in a very, very, very critical situation. So I saw that I could not maintain that same lifestyle. I could not maintain a big studio that I had in Brooklyn. And also, I was producing a lot of work. I made a lot of work. So I had four galleries. So only to keep nurturing, you know, with things, all these galleries and follow all the art fairs and solo shows. I was a high producer. So suddenly the money was not coming in. So I had to think of other, you know, of an alternative. So that was one issue. Another issue was that somehow I was also exhausted of this energy in New York. Maybe, you know, I was older and I felt that I was very lonely in the studio. That I had this extreme schedule of waking up, being in the studio at 8 in the morning, and a lot of times I made fun of my situation. It's like, oh, no, we don't have 9-to-5 jobs as artists. We have, like, 9-to-11 jobs. You know, it's like 12 hours in the studio. And it's also very solitary labor. You know, you're making all this artwork that then gets disseminated to galleries. It's spread around. And, you know, you have, reviews if you're lucky. You have sales if you're lucky. But I felt that there was no real dialogue. I was missing a real dialogue of having time and sitting and looking at what I was making. I was just making, and I was barely looking at what I was making. And I think that I felt the same with most of my friends. You know, we were crazy producing and flying here and flying there. And so I started having this crisis of like, hey, you know, I already know how to do that. I know how to wake up and have this discipline and make my own work and be engaged with my own ideas, but it's not challenging. There was an intellectual part that was not challenging. And I started thinking, how can I have a dialogue? How can I put in crisis my own ideas and learn something different. So I started feeling kind of dry and that I already knew the there was a routine in New York, you know, that I was like, you are alone all day in the studio and then you go to these openings, you know, weekly. So I was really, really exhausted of a similar pattern that I didn't know how to break. So I thought, it took me a while, but then I thought, what if, you know, it was really scary. The idea of living in New York was really scary. But suddenly it enters your psyche, and once it enters, like, hey, what are you afraid of? Why don't you challenge it? Maybe, you know, why not? Let's try that. So it seemed like a good opportunity to maybe apply to teaching jobs, you know? It's like, what else can I do? And it seemed like teaching would allow me to have this dialogue, to, you know, to have time to read, to share my readings, to talk with other people, to be open, you know, to different ideas. So I did a list. I checked the jobs openings, and I decided to apply to places that seem attractive, you know, like good schools, with good reputation, that that were not just, look, oh, I'm just having a job, you know. I didn't want a job. I wanted a place that was active with ideas, with interesting faculty, and that's how I got this job at VCU here in Virginia. Yeah.
And that sounds like it's a good scenario. So you're still working, you're still able to produce art, but it's a little more of a peaceful situation, a little more comfortable.
Yes, it is. I have way less time for my own artwork, so I am producing way slower, and I have really much more time, and I'm enjoying that. It's still a learning process to me. I still feel I have this anxiety of going fast, but I'm like, hey, you know, just you know, enjoy this different pace, and that's what I really needed. So, yeah, I have my studio in my house, and I keep on working, but I'm not in a rush. I want to really, really enjoy the process. I'm challenging it. I give myself time to try different things, and combine that with the high demands of the university, you know, teaching. And that gives me all these other world of, it's constant dialogue. Like, you talk all the time, the students talk to you. I'm learning a lot from them. Every year it's like a new generation of artists comes in with new interests, new music, new ideas, and that's very stimulating, you know.
Absolutely. So, Esther, yeah. It's really been wonderful talking to you in hearing the trajectory of your career, which I think a lot of people will relate to in different ways. The people listening to the show are artists of all kinds, of all ages, all over. In closing, is there something you want to say specifically to the artists out there who are listening about how they're struggling? Could be anything at all.
Just keep on doing it, you know. It's a very, very long practice, you know, and it takes a lot of shapes, and it will, you know, you have to constantly be attentive and readdress things and adjust, and it's all a learning and fascinating adventure. And nothing is final, you know, nothing is final in this career. That's all.
Esther, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.